The Tom Woods Show, episode 2207.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, if you've decided it's best not to have your kids educated by people who have declared war on you, then consider the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. Instructors like me will give your kids an unfair advantage and an education you and I could only have dreamed of. But make sure you join through my link, because only there do you get my $160 worth of free bonuses. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am thrilled to be able to talk once again to our friend Paul Gottfried. Paul holds a PhD in history from Yale, the author of, a zillion books, and a great friend of the Tom Woods Show. And I want to talk to him about, oh, and by the way, he's editor of Chronicles magazine. We'll talk about Chronicles a little bit later. But I want to talk about his remarks to the recent convention in Florida, of the National Conservatism Convention, that is. And Paul Gottfried gave a talk on fusionism, which was an idea that a guy named Frank Meyer came up with, try to reconcile conservatism and libertarianism. So I wanted to go over that with him. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me back.
All right. Well, we got to talk about your appearance at the National Conservatism Conference. First of all, can you tell me something about this? It's more than just a conference. It represents a kind of a movement, but yet the conference has such a bizarre variety of people, I can't entirely make sense of it.
Yeah, I think in some ways it's become sort of a kind of catch-all conservative right organization. In some ways, it is to the right of Con Inc. I think they did invite Rich Lowry to speak there once, but he sort of bombed out with his sort of centrist, anti-Trump kind of nationalism or pseudo-nationalism. So almost all the people they invited, I think, showed some kind of dissident right orientation, but none of them was, you know, extreme enough to be attacked, I suppose, as a white nationalist. If there was anything that distinguishes this group from, let's say, the Philadelphia Society or more conventional conservative gatherings, is the fact that they emphasize the Christian nature, you know, of the American polity. Only one person, and that was, I think, Michael Knowles, got up and said that, you know, Christian nationalism is great. Curiously, the leaders of the organization are Jewish, Orthodox Jews, but they seem to recognize that if the United States is to have any kind of cultural, moral identity, it is to be as a Christian nation. And historically, it was very much of a Protestant Christian nation until the end of the Second World War, when America sort of moved in the direction of a kind of anti-fascist liberalism. But there was nobody there who was recognizably neoconservative. And I think that represents an improvement over most conservative gatherings that, you know, have occurred since the 1980s, when the neoconservatives, yeah, you know, came to power and threw many of us out of the movement. And, you know, people who clearly are not neoconservatives and have been identified with the right, the dissident right, like myself, were invited to speak. So I do see here a kind of opening to a more authentic right than we've had certainly for the last 40 years. And I suppose the older I would argue, you know, ever since the 1930s or 1940s. So, I mean, that looks good. Another thing which I think I'm going to mention, you know, at the Mises Conference is the predominance of young people who are on the right. And they're not neoconservatives and they're not Ben Shapiro groupies or anything like that. They're clearly on the right. And if you mention someone like Senator Joe McCarthy, you get a very favorable reaction from the person you're talking to, which surprised me. If you say, you know, the Voting Rights Act didn't quite turn out, you know, the way some people may have hoped, or something, you're not going to be attacked as a racist. They probably will agree with it. Certainly the people under 40, and without doubt the people under 30, showed much more of a hard right-wing edge than I'm accustomed to seeing, you know, from going from my experience at the Philadelphia Society or people who write for ISI or National Review. So in those ways, I think this organization, although it is still somewhat amorphous in trying to, you know, sort of get its feet on the ground, if I may use a sort of a mixed metaphor, I think it does have a future. There were also a number of important politicians who were there. There was an excellent speech given by Ron DeSantis, which impressed me profoundly, because he says, we have to go after the left and do the following things. He's very systematic about this. Marco Rubio spoke, and even he didn't sound as bad as he usually does. Rick Scott didn't sound very good, but then, you know, I wouldn't expect much more from him. But yeah. DeSantis spoke well, and he addressed us for about an hour and a half. So this organization looks like, you know, it has, you know, the wind to its back, the wind in its sails right now.
Well, you know, as you were talking, I went and scrolled back through again, looked at the speakers, and I think my initial impression was faulty because Marco Rubio initially caught my eye, and then John Yoo caught my eye. I thought, well, John Yoo is also kind of what's wrong with some parts of the federal government. But the overwhelming majority of these people, some of them I don't know, but the ones I do know, some of them are my friends.
Right.
So I'm glad to see them featured there. I was very glad to see you featured there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, before we talk about your talk that you gave there, I want to revisit something that I think I probably must have asked you years ago in another appearance, but I probably was asking something like, supposing Trump loses in 2020, does the GOP go back to Romney / Bush / McCain, or has he left a permanent imprint? And I think, I could be wrong about this, and feel free to correct me, but I think your impression was, it's going to swing back to Romney.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There just isn't enough infrastructure for it to continue. But it now looks to me as if the Romneys are the underdogs all of a sudden in the GOP.
Yeah, I think you're right. At least partly because the Democrats, you know, poured lots of money into so-called extremists, right-wing extremists, who may very well win in these races for governor and senator. For instance, Doug Mastriano in my state, or Blake Masters in Arizona, what's his name, Baldock in New Hampshire. These people may actually win, you know, and in a way that, of course, is going to disappoint Brett Baer and Mitch McConnell and, you know, the other Romneyites. But when you asked me that question 2 or 3 years ago, I still put my money then on the Republican establishment. And I think the fact that populists have done well is at least partly attributable to Democratic money. The Republican Party and certainly the money that is being held by Mitch McConnell, this is not going to these candidates very freely. In my state, John Fetterman is much more heavily financed, thanks to the leftist coastal elites, than Dr. Oz, who has been hurting for money throughout the campaign since he won the primary.
Oh, and Fetterman is just
unbelievable.
Just awful. I mean, you cannot believe
he's as bad as he sounds.
Yeah. This just goes to show, as if you needed further evidence of the kind of narcissists who tend to pursue political office. You would think you would simply say, look, I obviously am not, you know, mentally capable of performing these duties, and it would be irresponsible of me to pursue this office any longer, and so I'm not going to do it. I mean, you would think you'd hear something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But doggone it, he is going to cling to this thing if it's the last thing he does.
Well, that's partly because he's being told by his handlers and by CNN and MSNBC that he's 20 points ahead. And there was a Franklin and Marshall poll, which, you know, a few weeks ago, which showed that he was, you know, 10, 15 points ahead. This, of course, is absolute nonsense. According to Trafalgar, Emerson, other Rasmussen, other reliable polls, they're almost neck and neck by now, which itself is appalling to me that, you know, there's so many people who actually would vote for Fetterman, given extreme positions he's taken and also given his mental condition right now.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about fusionism then. I'll say that as a youngish, and when I say youngish, I'm talking about like 20. As a youngish, I guess I didn't quite know what I was. I was some kind of person on the right. I had started off my, I guess, political life, you know, as a GOP guy, but not really knowing very much.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, in 1992, it seemed normal that we would have an election of Bill Clinton versus George H.W. Bush. It didn't, whereas right now that would just infuriate me. These are the choices. But, you know, but at that time I felt like we got to rally to, I don't know, you know, I was a young kid, but I was learning and reading. And I came across Frank Meyer. Like I read, it's not spectacular, but it gives you the names and the dates. The George H. Nash book, The History of the Conservative Movement in America since 1945. And so I looked at that and I thought, well, this Frank Meyer sounds interesting. So I read In Defense of Freedom. And I found it fairly convincing.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of his fusionist project was to try to resolve an internal debate on the right between libertarians and conservatives? And can we balance the libertarians' concern for liberty with the conservatives' concern for tradition and order? And he felt like that was not so difficult to do. But then ever since then, everyone has talked about what a big failure fusionism was and all that. But I don't know, Paul, if it weren't for fusionism and if it weren't for like the John Randolph Club, I wouldn't even know you. You know, it did bring some people together, right? We can't discount it entirely.
No, I'm not discounting it entirely. And I think most conservatives that I have known, whom I've known over the years, do represent some kind of internal fusion. That is to say, they strict constitutionalists generally are unhappy with the welfare state, but also believe in moral order, a deferential society, and so forth. This, I think, in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, even later, was sort of the typical conservative profile that both of us probably encountered, although I'm much older than you. But, you know, I think that this was true in the 1950s, 1960s, into the 1960s, which I remember, people generally held what we consider to be sort of fusionist views. But I think what Frank Meyer is doing is something very different. He is trying to bring together different camps of the post-war conservative movement, which at that time was sort of centered around National Review, and later sort of modern age in the mid-1960s comes along. But National Review is pretty much the intellectual heart of the conservative movement back then. And he sees that, you know, these people on the right and left are arguing, and he wants to bring them together, above all, to fight communism. Because, you know, if you read In Defense of Freedom, you know, people very often overlook all of the passages in which he's talking about how we have to be united in this cosmic struggle against the absolute evil of communism, and how we can't do any of these things until we've defeated the communist enemy. So, you know, when our shared late friend Murray Rothbard said, you know, Frank Meyer, I really agree with his. Well, I think what Murray was not thinking about was the militant Cold War spirit, which underlies that particular book, and which I think animated its production. The book also has sort of like a grand sweep of history, which is inaccurate. And this was Frank's view. I knew him, that, you know, somehow a continental European civilization was about order and morality and this, whereas the Anglo-American people have liberty, and we're sort of, you know, bringing them together in some way. The problem is the way he brings them together resonates much more strongly with the libertarian camp. I mean, that's why Murray Rothbard liked that work, whereas Robert Nisbet and Russell Kirk did not. Nor did James Burnham, who thought, didn't like all the moralizing in the book because he was a kind of political Machiavellian political realist. So I think in the end, Frank falls between two stools in writing that work. But I can understand why the idea of, you know, of a combination or a mixture of economic freedom and moral social order would appeal to conservatives. And as I indicate in my longer speech, the one that I did not give because I was only limited to 13 minutes, but if you look at our Chronicles blog, it's there, I talk about the attempt to bring back this fusionism in Ronald Reagan. Remember, he talked about the three pillars or whatever conservative movement stood, free enterprise, moral order, and fighting communism or strong national defense or something like that. So what I think happens is you get variations, you know, on this fusionist theme, although not necessarily the formulation of it that we find in Frank Meyer in 1962.
Well, you seem to imply in the talk that, and of course, I'll link to the talk on the show notes page, but you seem to imply that the emphasis on waging the Cold War among conservatives, which, by the way, I'm fairly certain is an emphasis you yourself no doubt shared at the time, may have come at the expense of emphasizing the fight against, let's say, I'll say something really sinister, the domestic enemy. And that, you know, yes, it's true that the Soviet Union fell and all that stuff, but then look at the wreckage of a country you have. Is that something you think about now?
Absolutely. You're right. I think about it all the time. And I was, of course, carried away by the Cold War. I was extremely anti-Soviet, anti-communist. I believed the stuff I was reading in National Review and thought that this country was, you know, was essentially sound and we were the good guys and so forth. But then, as you said, that, you know, you're looking at the wreckage, the moral, cultural, social wreckage of this country. And I'm also looking at what the United States was by the end of the Cold War. And I've argued we were the more leftist power by the end of the Cold War, because we were already pushing gay marriage or gay rights, all the rest of the stuff that we now have, feminism. And the communists ran an unpleasant, autocratic, militaristic society. But I think they had more of a sense of traditional social order and, you know, were less morally corrupted in terms of social morality than the United States and certainly Europe and Canada have become, you know, since the Cold War.
So let's think about Frank Meyer today. Now, first of all, the movement, such as it is, has grown much larger and more fragmented and splintered.
Right.
So it's not really as neat as it was in his day, where we have these people who think this and those people who think that, and let's see if we can find some overlap. Now we have a whole bunch of groups who can't stand each other.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the vast majority of the libertarian world would not even be considered to be part of the right.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he couldn't care less what they think. And in general, I would say at this stage, you know, most of the, let's say, well-known like celebrity libertarians and institutions and stuff are just a complete waste of everybody's time. The ones who are actually popular, you know, don't get on national television as much. But the ones, you know, the ones who get on Joe Rogan and 10, 20 million people listen to them are out there, and those are good. But the ones the regime approves of, mm-hmm. you can imagine how terrible they are. So I wonder if he looked at this, what would he even say? I think he'd probably want to do kind of what Murray Rothbard wanted to do in the 1990s, which was to try to see if we could find non-neocons who, after the Cold War, want to have basically a normal country again, and let's see what we can learn from each other. I bet he would probably have wanted that.
I agree. No, I'm not entirely negative on Frank Meyer, who was, you know, a kind of mentor of mine when I was in graduate school. And I liked him and his wife and his sons. I've since come to know a great deal. So I do not intend to demean him. And I think you're right. I think that we are living in an age in which there is need for a fusion of all the sane, sound elements on the right. I mean, we have to find some way to get together to reconcile our differences. But, you know, it cannot be done with a grand theory of history, which is, I think, one of the things Frank had in mind, that, you know, we have to show how these two streams are coming together in the United States historically. And so I think this is nonsense. What we have to do now is, you know, preserve what there is of sanity, a sound social order, constitutional liberties, things like that. And I think all people of goodwill have to be working together at this point, because we are in we are much more desperate straits now than we were in 1962.
I think there's something that conservatism has that libertarianism generally does not have, but it would be much better off if it did.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a sense of tragedy in the world. So, mm-hmm. for example, if I walk around parts of Los Angeles at night, I'm going to see things that are just going to boggle my mind. I know that because I've done it.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at, there are, I don't know how many people who are absolute lost souls on the streets of Los Angeles. And I'm picking Los Angeles at random. You know, there are other places I could choose.
Right.
But there are lost souls everywhere, wandering around cities. And much of it is drugs, maybe some's mental illness, but a lot of it's drugs. A lot of it's they've made bad choices. And there are libertarians who seem to think, see, one great thing about conservatism is that conservatives will say, at least they used to say, some things have no political solution. Whereas libertarians feel like, no, there has to be a solution. And the solution is the state must be causing this because mm-hmm. it's our one enemy. Because we are against organized aggression, and only the state engages in organized mm-hmm, aggression. Mm-hmm. So the state. So this must be because of zoning policies, or, you know, we can't.
Right.
It's because there's a housing shortage, and then that's why these people are acting like this. If that's the way you think, I don't know what to tell you. But that's not the problem. And if you're misdiagnosing the problem, there ain't no way you're going to come up with a solution. Now, I'm sure if you deregulated housing markets in various places, you know, probably things would improve marginally. I'm not opposed to that.
Right.
But I am opposed to deceiving myself as to what's happening before my eyes.
Yeah, I have a problem. It's sort of a similar problem. It's sort of a lack of a tragic understanding of history in the regular conservative movement, Conservatism Incorporated. These people somehow believe that all the reforms undertaken in this country, the Civil Rights Movement, the Voting Rights Act, even the Immigration Act in the 1960s, all of these things have led to a much more just society. We've overcome the race problems of the past, and we're just waiting for all the blacks to become Republicans, and then this will sort of start. And supposedly it's happening. If you turn on Fox News and listen to certain programs, and people tell you, how much better everything is becoming right now. Well, I see everything going exactly the opposite direction. And I'm not saying that, one can attribute all of this to the landmark Civil Rights or Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, but I think the wrong path was taken at some point in the past. And most social racial problems I'm looking at are a lot worse now than they were in the 1960s. And to pretend anything else because, we have integrated schools or something like this is absolutely ridiculous. We are in a much worse situation. One of the points that I'm always making is one does not have to justify every abuse that happened in the past. I do not defend racial segregation. I think it's demeaning to Black people. On the other hand, I think the Civil Rights Movement had disastrous consequences. And you sort of go back, as an historian, I also like doing counterfactual history. You say if other paths were taken in the past, we might have landed up in a better place. But the conservative movement does not really want to consider this. Apparently, the wrong turn that was taken was electing Biden. If we had elected another Republican, things would not be. This, too, I think, shows a sort of a lack of historical understanding and also a lack of tragedy that people make serious mistakes, even in some cases when they're trying to improve matters. And it is, someone like Victor Davis Hanson, so I usually agree with him on contemporary affairs, but when he starts talking about history, it sounds like utter nonsense, that the Civil War was great, we fought for freedom, Reconstruction didn't go far enough, and so forth. These people do not understand that serious mistakes were made by the left, by the progressives, the effects of which we are still dealing with today. And their sense of progress is much too exaggerated for them to understand real past mistakes carried out by people whom they consider to be progressives.
Hey, everybody, I want to recommend a person to you. And that person is Mikkel Thorup, who was my guest on episode 2183. And Mikkel is the host of the Expat Money Show, which is the number one resource for anybody considering the expat lifestyle or offshore investments. Your host, Mikkel Thorup, has been an expat for over 20 years. He's visited over 100 countries and himself lived in 9. And so he has invaluable insight on the expat lifestyle. And that includes how to maximize international investments, how to move offshore for more freedom, privacy, and protection. You're going to gain vital knowledge on wealth protection, tax reduction, investing, migration, citizenship, residency, you name it. You're going to love Mikkel as a person because he's very knowledgeable without being an arrogant jerk. And the variety of topics he covers on the Expat Money Show, where he's telling you about all different countries, all different things you might want to do there, like buying property or getting a job. All this stuff is covered on the Expat Money Show. So go to expatmoney.com today. The link will be in the show notes. That's expatmoney.com, or listen wherever you get your podcasts. So here we are in 2022. We don't know what's coming in November just yet. As we record this, it's second half of September. You would think, in fact, I wish I could call it up. I wish I thought to get it ready. I'm only thinking of it now. But I had a tweet recently where I said, sorry, this is the state of civilization. My thoughts are encapsulated on Twitter instead of, in an article somewhere. But I said something like, okay, progressives are more or less running on something like, let's see, we're going to brainwash your kids without your knowledge about highly controversial gender theories, to put it mildly. Then we're going to make sure that energy is much more expensive for you. Prices are going through the roof, and we have no real explanation for or solution to that. We've checked and found out that Cockroach milk is actually quite nutritious for you, so keep that in mind for the future. And you listen to this laundry list. You know, in the old days, at least progressivism would, you understand why the mid-range intelligence person would go for it, because it just sounded like they're trying to make things better for the average person. But they're just flatly saying, if you listen to them, we're actually going to make things worse for you. Everything you want is going to be more expensive because we have to transition to this other kind of green economy, whatever. So you put this all together, you would think, how could a Republican possibly lose running against this? This is incredible. It's like they designed it themselves. Like, this is what I would like to run against, you know? And yet what's odd is that so many of these races are going to be close.
Well, there are good reasons they're going to be close. College-educated white women for whom late-term abortion, you know, is a hill to die on right now. Even though in Europe, you know, in these progressive countries, abortion is only permissible for 12 or 14 weeks or something like that. And, you know, I speak to such women, and they're quite convinced that the overturning of Roe v. Wade is going to lead to the destruction of their taking away what they call health issues or health reproductive issues, which means your right to kill your unborn child. But this is very important. You know, and the Republicans aren't doing enough for the gays or for the LGBT lobby. And then, of course, you have the black vote, and blacks are still angry at whites because they view whites as racist. Therefore, they vote for political candidates who allow their neighborhoods to be devastated. But, you know, there are a lot of crazy voters out there. In the latest issue of Chronicles, I argue that we're suffering from the consequences of too many people being on the voting roll. That in order to maintain a constitutional republic, you have to be very selective about who votes, as Plato, Aristotle, you know, and others have pointed, even Rousseau pointed out to us. So, and certainly the founding fathers of the United States.
Yeah, but the thing is that some people would have said, the problem is that many of the, because obviously from a libertarian point of view, there's no quote unquote right to vote. Like, this is a made up thing, because there's, from a strict libertarian point of view, there's no right for these people to be having to be forcing us to vote on our own destinies. You know, whether my property gets taken away, whether my kids get brainwashed, I shouldn't have to vote in the first place. But this idea, there's a right to this is that's not a natural right. This is all this. There's no such thing. But the thing is, the various restrictions you might place, you might say, well, you know, you have to be literate or you have to be educated, or but then that's just going to put some of the worst people in the world voting, people who quote unquote, people who think they're educated. Most of these people you're saying, you know, who are college educated, they're not actually educated, as you know. Like what they have in their brains is the exact opposite of an education.
Right, I agree.
So the problem would be, how do we exclude them?
Well, you can't exclude them entirely. If I had to vote today on the 19th Amendment, I'd vote against it, because the net result of having women vote has been, in every Western country, has been to push these countries toward the social cultural left. So, you know, of course, I would not have been aware of that in 1918 or 1919.
No.
But this has turned out very badly. But I think if you have things like residence qualification, property qualifications, things of that nature, it probably would have a restricted. I mean, you're not going to go back to, you know, to white male property holders who belong to the state church or something like that. But, you know, I think what we're seeing now is a vast inflation of voting rolls, because you can't even insist that people identify themselves properly when they come to vote, because that in the United States, if not in France, England, Germany, or even Canada, is considered to be a racist act. But at this point, it's sort of hard, you know, to go back and say, what exactly are we going to do? Because as I've argued, once you grant the vote, you can't take it back. You're stuck with it. The only thing that we can hope for is that voter identification continues to be required, because this will keep, you know, further voting fraud from occurring. We can hope.
Well, I mean, and this is such a trivial request. I mean, you know, the way they, when you ask for the tiniest thing, you know, they act like it's the Middle Passage all over again. Or something, you know, it's unbelievable. It is, and of course, it shows how they infantilize blacks. Mm. Like, they can't possibly have an ID. I'm pretty sure they can. You know, I actually am pretty darn sure they can. So what's your real reason for this, right?
Well, we know what the real reason is. They want to cheat. So they're guys.
Right.
You know, I've been looking at the, reading the remarks made by Crystal Matthews, who's Tim Scott's opponent in the senatorial race in South Carolina. And she apparently laced into the white race and expressed her hatred of white people and so forth. And the South Carolina Democratic Party is thinking about whether to remove her as a candidate or something like that. Well, I mean, she's getting a lot of money, again, from white coastal elites. They're giving her money. They're also sending their money to John Fetterman, who wants to release murderers from jail. And you wonder about, you know, I do know some of these people, but I still wonder about their sanity, these sort of, you know, the affluent white liberals who support anti-white black racist maniacs, who support people who want to open up jails and let everybody out, who support the transgendered education for pre-kindergarten kids and so forth. I do not understand why these people are so crazy in their political positions and whom they back. I mean, I can write books on the subject, but nonetheless, I remain perplexed.
Yeah. You are editor of Chronicles magazine, which I subscribe to. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just got one recently, and I'm trying to think. I have an old issue right here, right next to my computer, where I keep the issue here so that I have something to read while I eat lunch, because I usually do a working lunch, and I read Chronicles. But for people who don't know Chronicles, maybe you can talk about what your, like, some interesting pieces that you have coming up. Because I will say that Chronicles has a special place in my heart, because it is the first place where I had a published article. Mm-hmm. And it was years ago, it was like 1994. And I've written a number of times since then. And I love it. It's a great, stimulating magazine. It's not stupid. It's not written by 20-somethings who know how to turn on a computer and blog. It's written by people who actually have lived for a while and have acquired the knowledge that therefore gives them the right to say something, if we may be that blunt.
Yeah, I think your description is entirely accurate. And I must commend you on having very good lunch reading.
Thank you.
No, the new issue of the magazine, I'm referring to the October issue. The September issue is already out, thanks to our executive editor, Ed Welsh, who keeps pushing these issues out one after the other, because we were behind schedule for several years. But the October issue has an excellent article by Patrick Basham on why the Republicans are going to win both houses of Congress and why most of the pollsters are either lying or are using highly defective methodologies to arrive at their questionable predictions for the upcoming election. I recommend his piece. It's sort of the central piece of the issue. But then we have a number of other pieces, which, including mine, might mention my piece, which is an examination of the franchise and the disaster of having a universal franchise while at the same time trying to preserve a constitutional order. There is a very fine piece by Anthony Eslin, who is a, as everyone knows, a brilliant linguist, a very fine stylist, and it's on I Promessi Sposi, Manzoni's famous Italian novel of the 1820s. We have a very good mixture of literary piece. We have a piece by Bruce Fronin on the relevance of Edmund Burke. So what we try to do is provide a mixture of cultural articles, historical material, and discussions of current events. And I think every issue of our magazine, you know, has this kind of interesting medley of articles. For those who are not subscribing, I urge you to go online and subscribe in the next half hour, if possible.
Well, chroniclesmagazine.org is the website. Now, you can subscribe and get a digital version, but come on now. I know, listening here, there are some people who are old-fashioned like me who like to hold the magazine in their hands, have mm-hmm. a physical thing. You know, I look at screens all day long. I want a break from the screen. So, and plus, you know what? Remember how in the old days it was fun to get something in the mail? Mm-hmm. You'd go to your mailbox and it was, instead of junk mail, you had a magazine waiting for you. Well, there's no reason you can't still have that experience now. And Paul is right about the variety of stuff you're going to read. And the quality of the stuff is very high. And so you're going to be smarter, for one thing. You're going to be much, much smarter. And you're not going to be reading people who are going to be walking on eggshells, and I want to say this, but I better say that. Or I'm quoting this person, but I know this person has said a forbidden thing, so let me make sure you all know I don't agree with that forbidden thing. You know, if that's what you want, the internet is full of that, okay? But if you want just fearless, smart people who are tired of letting the enemies of civilization tell them what they can say and write, then you should subscribe to Chronicles Magazine. You know, I should be on the staff, for heaven's sake, the appeals I make for this thing.
No, you should. You've been raising more money for us than any of our other fundraisers. So.
That's awesome.
and you do it gratis.
That's right. Just because I feel like you know how they say, I wanted to give something back. Well, here's a case where Chronicles really has given me things, and I do want to give something back. So
you Chronicles can also write for us if you want. I mean, it's an open invitation, and we'd love to have something, you know, from your word processor.
I don't want to give that much back.
Okay.
These days, for years now, almost all my published writing has just been for my newsletter subscribers. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm cutting off potential new readers, and I should be posting the newsletter on my blog, which I haven't been doing. It's just that it keeps me so busy just to do that. And, you know, it's giving me a comfortable life. And so if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But if something occurs to me that's original, there isn't anywhere else I'd want to send it to than Chrome.
Well, thank you. And we eagerly await your original thought and the article you choose from it.
Thank you so much. Well, in the meantime, I'm happy to say you made brief mention of it, but I'm happy to say that you and I are going to be seeing each other at the 40th anniversary of the Mises Institute, mm-hmm. the Supporters Summit, happening October 6th through the 8th in Phoenix. So those of you just finding out about that now, I hope there are still seats for you because it's going to be a very special event. And I can't exactly tell you why, but there's going to be a great surprise at that event. So head over to Mises.org/events and you can meet Paul and me there. So Paul, thanks so much for your time and continued success with Chronicles.
Thank you very much.
All right, everybody. I realize that we're well into September at this point, and some people have already made the decision we're going to send our kid to the brick and mortar school, but maybe you're a few weeks in and you're thinking, oh gosh, no. No, 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 no. I'll tell you something. The good news is it's never too late to try out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And if you're going to do that, you'd be crazy not to use my link because you also get a bunch of free things if you use my link, which is ronpaulhomeschool.com. See y'all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.